Natural Living with Gary Nall, Mondays and Tuesdays at 3 p.m. on the Progressive Radio Network.
Live from New York City, it's the Gary Nall Show. And now, your host, Gary Nall.
Hi, everyone. I'm Gary Nall, and I'd like to welcome you to this program. We call this the Empowerment Hour. Why? Because during the next 60 minutes, we're going to cover the latest on health and healing, important issues involving the environment. We'll take questions and comments that are constructive from people in the audience, and also, as we've done on KPFK and PFW for 25 years, and on non-commercial radio for 33 years and 6 months, the longest-running, uninterrupted non-commercial radio program in American history. We deal with important social issues, not from the right and left, as I do not take a political stance as belonging to one or another, but rather looking at something as objectively as possible, and then deciding what's the problem, and more important, what are the solutions. Today we're going to be talking with Lieutenant General Dirk Jameson. General Jameson, it was the former Deputy Commander-in-Chief of Staff of the U.S. Strategic Command, the successor to the Strategic Air Command, and responsible for military satellites and missile defense and global command and counterintelligence. And as the command's chief, General Jameson was responsible for all the nation's intercontinental ballistic missiles and participating in nuclear reforms with Russia and its military leaders. And during his active military commission, he had numerous nuclear-related assignments. He is also a graduate of the National War College, has an MBA from Ohio State, and attended Harvard University's Kennedy School National Security Program. We're speaking to General Jameson, who is now in Washington, D.C., as part of a prestigious group of military and national security leaders, the Consensus for American Security, who are seeking to press the Senate to ratify a new Strategic Arms Reduction Treaty, or START, that will solidify a more sustainable nuclear security policy. Nice to have you with us today, General.
Thank you very much. It's very good to be with you.
One of the issues I would like for you to address, if you would please, is that we are now seeing, especially in more conservative media circles, an attack against the idea that we should do any negotiating on nuclear strategic positions with Russia or the BRIC nations. And that, if anything, we should actually be accelerating our development and deployment of nuclear weapons. And for those of us who do not see that as a viable option to peace, I'd like for you to address that as part of an overall understanding to this audience. Many people in this audience are probably not familiar with the type of verification system that would be in place if we had this Strategic Arms Reduction Treaty. I believe certainly the majority of people in this audience are aligned with the idea that the less nuclear weapons in the world, the greater opportunity for peace, the more, and depending upon who has those, there's always that possibility of a rogue state or someone deciding to use nuclear weapons. We're concerned about this. Could you give us your overview, please?
Yes. I think it might be best to start by saying that I'm a part of a group of retired military general officers and flag officers who are very experienced in matters nuclear over a long period of time. I call it a consensus of experienced national security personnel that want to see this treaty ratified because they've been there through the years of the Cold War and into the new era that we're in now, which is the post-Cold War era that represents a lot of changes to the global national security or the global equation. And we're very concerned that this treaty that has been hammered out over time and has been presented now to the Senate for ratification will fall through the crack. It is a fact that when I started in the nuclear business, the numbers were low, and then they went up. They went up at a precipitous rate over decades because we knew how to build, as a country, we knew how to build platforms, and those technologies presented themselves so we could add warheads to each platform. So there was a line of deployment on the chart that went up. And in those days, there was no communication across the Iron Curtain. We had very little information about what was going on in the Soviet Union. There was a very dangerous period for the whole world. And in that environment, people started saying, why do we continue to escalate the numbers when in fact it's far more than we can employ on our side, and it's far more than the other side could really employ with, and the net result, if they did employ them, would be total devastation, not just of those two countries, but of the larger global structure. And so they began very tentatively to talk across the Iron Curtain. Very courageous people. It began in the just before the Nixon administration, and they started to hammer out processes and procedures and understandings that led to the first treaties that were signed and ratified, and by the way, ratified with large majorities in the Senate, which requires 67 votes. It requires two-thirds of the Senate to vote in ratification, but those earliest treaties were ratified almost unanimously, numbers like 99-1 or 93-4 or something like that. And as we've seen that progress through the years to follow-on treaties, those numbers of senators voting for these treaties in a nonpartisan or bipartisan way have remained extremely high until now. For some reason, we are seeing a gridlock and a determination on the part of some to denigrate the progress that's been made. Now, the progress has not been made through trust. It's been made through hard-fought negotiations, hammered out so that the United States gets what it wants. And Russia, as a follow-on to the Soviet Union, of course, has to defend their own requirements. But in the end, we end up with a treaty that preserves these processes, that preserves and adds to and streamlines the verification processes to make a treaty that is beneficial to the United States from a national security point of view. And we have in that process the Russians, who have arrived at the position, if their Duma chooses to ratify, that it's in their best interest. And these are the two countries that control 95% of the world's nuclear weapons. So if we talk from that perspective, I'd like to go forward and answer your questions. It's a very critical time in continuing the processes and I think the benefits of arms control based on verification and not trust.
Yes, it does. My questions are in alignment with this basic theme. Even though I am not a pro-war person, I think the last resort is to use any form of deterrent that could end the life as we know it for ourselves or others. I also know that we have to have in place individuals who have the capacity to understand when to use and when not to use any form of force. And I believe right now, when watching some of the people on television, they're not using any judgment that is reasonable and responsible. They're coming at this as a, and I'm not sure why. I would have to guess, but I'm interested in your opinion on this, why they would be opposed to this treaty. Why do they not want to see some form of mutual verification to keep us in a state where it's less likely that nuclear weapons be used rather than more likely?
Well, I regret to say that I'm worried that it is strictly political, and we can't afford a political answer at this point. I mean, there is ample demonstration that anything that seems to add to one side's progress is an anathema. And as I said, I represent a group of generals and admirals that are nonpartisan, that don't look at this from a political perspective, and that believe, along with the most recent commanders of the Strategic Command and former commanders of the Strategic Air Command and the current commander of the Strategic Command and any number of luminaries in our national security history, including people like James Schlesinger and Bill Perry and Henry Kissinger and Brent Scowcroft, and the list goes on, are advocating that this treaty be solved. I'm worried that the American people may have lost the bubble on nuclear. Nuclear has not gone away. In some ways, we're in a much more dangerous environment than we were after the fall of the Berlin Wall and the end of the Soviet Union. Naturally, we were in great danger through the Cold War, but after that was over, the American people may have it in their heads that's all behind us. We don't need to worry about it. In fact, there are tens of thousands of nuclear weapons, and we need to continue to keep our eyes strictly on the fact that Russia is a country that could destroy us and our way of life. We have no reason right now to believe that we're enemies. I don't believe we're enemies. But why would we, in this circumstance, walk away from these processes that have allowed us to be inside Russia, verifying the status of nuclear forces, their nuclear forces, on a 24-hour a day, 7 days a week basis, right up until the 5th of December in 2009, now almost 300 days ago, when we called ourselves off because we don't have a ratified treaty. Now, that defies logic.
My last question for you. When we look at the economic front today, the United States, according to many different economic factors, plus its impressive pressure in the world as a country that has the right to steer the global economy and the legitimacy of the dollar that is now very weak, we are finding emerging countries, Russia, China, Brazil, and India, the BRIC nations, demanding the playing field be more level. In the past, it was usually the U.S. through our international multilateral organizations who more often than not dictated the terms. So while there is fear that the failure to ratify START will jeopardize America's national security, how open and transparent is the treaty for Russia to inspect our nuclear arsenals as well?
Well, it allows the Russians to verify, just as it allows us to verify. But let's be quite honest. We've had that circumstance going on with the Russians since 1994, at least under START 1. The verification procedures were more of them because there were more nuclear delivery platforms and there were more locations. There were actually more states because before the Soviet Union came apart, you had Kazakhstan and Ukraine and Uzbekistan and Belarus. Now, those countries have eliminated their nuclear weapons, and now we have a lower number of locations and systems to verify, and we have a very good verification system. I think from a global perspective, you know, we have large economic interests with China. Russia is a lower amount by quite a bit, but there's opportunity there. What we've seen as Russia and the United States have reached agreement on this treaty to submit it to their legislative bodies for ratification is some signs of greater involvement of greater possible economic advantages for both sides. I, for the life of me, in this economy, and not because we're threatened or because we're coerced, I cannot understand why this would be some kind of a roadblock to taking this treaty forward. This treaty is either a bridge to a future that is more secure for us, and it's more secure for the world, or it's an obstacle to doing a lot of things that are in our best interest and shouldn't be dealt with on a political basis.
I would agree with that. All the best to you and this group of retired admirals and generals and others who care about the safety of the United States and care about ratification of the Strategic Arms Reduction Treaty. We certainly support your efforts on that. Could you give us your website, please?
Well, I certainly will give you the website. And I also would like to say that it's very important right now until the end of this year for people to take up their pen and write a little note to their senator and say, for Pete's sake, I believe this is important, and I want you to vote for it. Now, the website is consensussecurity.org.
Consensussecurity.org. Let your legislator in the Senate know, yes, on ratification of the Strategic Arms Reduction Treaty, or START, and let's put politics out of the equation and peaceful solutions into the equation. Thank you very much, Lieutenant General Dirk Jameson.
Thank you so much.
I'm Gary Noll, back in a moment with two commentaries. And Glenn Beck, I'd like for you to hear a real history lesson that's not made up for political reasons in a moment. This is the one program on radio where progressive and independent-minded people come. You're looking for different perspectives other than those that are so cliched. You know already in advance when Keith Urban has the same tired group of people on, what they're going to say, the minute and a half or 2 minutes he's going to give them. You know that O'Reilly's going to jump in and argue about everything and dominate. You know that Lumbaugh is going to be bashing people. You know that so much of what we hear is just doom and gloom and negative or blaming. Why not take a look at the truth of an issue and how we can resolve it and how we can grow from it? That's what we try to do. Health, nutrition, the environment, alternative healing, but also every single day, 15 hours a week. Tomorrow morning it'll be 6 hours if you live on the East Coast. I'm on KPFK, our sister station, where I've been for 25 years, every week for 6 hours, and the number one downloaded show live on all of that, and I'm starting at 3 a.m. on the East Coast. So 3 to 9 a.m. tomorrow morning, West Coast, midnight to 6. So now I'm going to share a commentary. This is from Fred Branfman of Alternet. And it shows you what no one is touching in the American media, left or right, but is relevant because these are the people that we're allowing to control the society and its body politic and its direction, and they're wrong. Let's start with Hillary Clinton, and the State Department is going to celebrate the war criminal Henry Kissinger while the White House repeats his deadly mistakes as if Obama can't learn anything. Nothing more symbolizes how the temptations of power can corrupt youthful values and idealism than Secretary Hillary Clinton's invitation to Henry Kissinger and Richard Holbrooke to keynote a major State Department conference on the history of the Indochina War, Vietnam War. As an idealistic college student, Clinton protested Kissinger's mass murder of civilians in Indochina. She knows full well that had the international laws protecting civilians in war been applied to Kissinger's bombing of civilian targets in Indochina, he'd be in jail for the rest of his life indicted as for crimes against humanity. But in just another week, she will introduce Kissinger at the State Department's Historians Conference, giving him a platform to continue 40 years of Orwellian deception in which he has sought to blame Congress for the fall of Indonesia, the fall of Saigon, rather than accepting responsibility for his massive miscalculations and indifference to human suffering. Clinton has also invited Richard Holbrooke, who as State Department head in Afghanistan and Pakistan policy, has learned nothing from history and is repeating precisely the same policies that caused the U.S. to lead the effort that led to the loss of Indochina, I should say, and also to support a very corrupt and very unpopular regime that cannot stand on its own. Inviting Holbrooke is particularly egregious because following Obama's strategy review, according to Bob Woodward's new book, quote, perhaps the most pessimistic view came from Richard Holbrooke. It can't work, he said, lacking even a fraction of the integrity and moral courage of a gentleman we had on the show recently, Daniel Ellsberg. Holbrooke continues to promote in public a policy with a smile, an optimism, where privately he believes we're doomed to fail. Inviting Henry Kissinger to keynote a conference on U.S. history in Indochina insults history. The memories of tens of thousands of Americans and countless Indochinese people who needlessly died as a result of his policies, the young people of America who desperately need to learn the truth about what occurred in Indochina so as not to repeat it, and all those who oppose indiscriminate mass murder of civilians. Giving Kissinger and Holbrooke a platform also has important policy implications for the present. An attempt to currently make us all build support for today's war-making in Afghanistan and Pakistan by claiming that, well, we lost in Indonesia because Congress cut the aid to the government. This view is being articulated not only by Kissinger and other Nixon-off officials, but a whole younger cadre of military officers, most notably Lieutenant Colonel Louis Sorley in his book, A Better War, which has been, according to the Wall Street Journal, quote, recommended in multiple lists put out by military officers, including a former U.S. commander in Afghanistan who passed it on to his subordinates. As President Obama was considering Afghan policy last fall, Newsweek reported that, quote, Louis Sorley's book argues that the military was stabbed in the back by its civilian leaders. The U.S. could have won Vietnam if only the U.S. Congress hadn't cut off military aid to South Vietnam. The most surprising guidance Vietnam may have to offer to Afghanistan is not that wars of this kind are unwinnable, but that they can produce victories if presidents resist the temptation to fight wars halfway or on the cheap, unquote. This is absurd. Anyone in this audience knows this is absurd. The evidence is overwhelming that the South Vietnamese government, Nguyen Cao Ky and Thu, lost to its enemies because it was a corrupt and unpopular police state, brutal to its own citizens. And its troops were far less motivated to fight than those of other countries. U.S. military aid to Saigon in 1974-75 was 2 to 4 times as great as Soviet and Chinese aid to the North Vietnamese. And the South Vietnamese army was well supplied with the latest arms and technology. Had all the ammunition and fuel right up to the very end. Kissinger's mistake in Vietnam, like Obama's and Petraeus' policy in Afghanistan today, was to try to prop up a completely unpopular, totally 100% corrupt government. You can't find an honest person in those stinking governments. They can't stand on their own. It is not Congress, but Henry Kissinger and Presidents Ford and Nixon who bear the full responsibility for the fall of Saigon. Henry Kissinger managed U.S. policy in Indochina as National Security Advisor for President Nixon, Secretary of State Gerald Ford, from January 20, 1969 until the fall of Saigon on April 30, 1975. And during this time, Kissinger needlessly prolonged the U.S. war making in which 20,853 Americans were killed and officially U.S. estimated 10,770,000 Indonesian civilians were murdered, maimed, or made homeless. Most of these lives could have been saved had Kissinger negotiated a deal with the North Vietnamese in 1969, as was urged by Averill Harriman, Clark Clifford, Cyrus Vance, and many others. Such a deal would have allowed the U.S. to leave Vietnam with far more dignity than occurred with the total defeat of U.S.-supported forces in April of 1975. And by the way, official statistics in this and succeeding areas shows that we could have gotten out, we should have gotten out, and we did not get out. For the same reason we're not getting out of Iraq and Afghanistan, the same mindset, the same incipient syncopaths of war like Sean Hannity and Glenn Beck and these other warmongers, they keep saying, more money, support your general, support the surge. Nonsense. Much of the bombing that occurred was on civilian targets. And it was Henry Kissinger, individually, who orchestrated the most massive bombing in world history. How much? Here, Glenn Beck, here's real numbers. We dropped 3,984,563 tons on an area inhabited by 50 million people. Twice the 2 million tons dropped on hundreds of millions through Europe and the Pacific in World War II. He dropped 1.6 million tons on South Vietnam, as many as Lyndon Johnson had at the height of the U.S. involvement, quadrupled the bombing of Laos from 454,200 to 1,628,900 million tons of bombs, and then initiated the widespread bombing of previously very peaceful Cambodia, including secret B-52 carpet bombing, and these were undefended, innocent civilians in villages, for a total of 600,000, 1 million tons, a vastly expanded amount of bombing of civilian targets than in North Vietnam. In Laos, where over 1,000 refugees were interviewed by just one report from the Plain of Jars, every single one said their village had been destroyed by U.S. bombing, which escalated tremendously in 1969, and that the main victims were civilians because the soldiers could move through the thick forest largely undetected, while old people, mothers and children, were forced to stay near their villages. In Cambodia, Kissinger told Alexander Haig, I met Haig 2 years ago on a PBS station in West Palm Beach. We had a little conversation. He was not happy about my comments about his warmongering. In other words, and it was then that Haig and Kissinger decided to do a massive bombing campaign in Cambodia. Anything that flies or anything that moves, the clearest possible violation of international law requiring the protection of civilians. 2 million people in Khmer Rouge zones, as estimated by the U.S. Embassy, were driven underground by massive U.S. bombing that features regular B-52 carpet bombing and of undefended villages. In North Vietnam, Kissinger conducted the most savage B-52 bombing of urban targets in world history. As the New York Times reported in 1972, quote, the United States military leaders are being permitted to wage the air war as they want in Indochina. There appears to be less concern with the civilians this time in view of the freedom given the air commanders in the attempt to cut off food, clothing, and medical supplies, unquote. Kissinger boasted to Richard Nixon, and it was on one of the tapes, quote, it's wave after wave of planes. You see, they can't see the B-52s in the air, and they dropped millions of pounds of bombs. I bet you we will have had more planes over there in one day than Johnson had in the north. Each plane can carry about 10 times the load of a World War II plane can carry, unquote. Nice that we actually hear what someone actually was thinking and saying from those tapes. Kissinger orchestrated the U.S. invasion of Cambodia, a disastrous miscalculation that led directly to the Khmer Rouge takeover 5 years later. All you had to do is visit Cambodia in April 1970, shortly after the U.S. supported Lon Nol in overthrowing Prince Sihanouk. U.S. embassy officials then estimated there were no more than 100 Khmer Rouge and were not even sure the Khmer Rouge leader, Samphan or Seri, were alive. As William Shawcross wrote in Sideshow, Kissinger-Nixon Destruction of Cambodia, it was Kissinger's overthrowing Sihanouk, supporting the corrupt and unpopular Lon Nol regime and massive bombing that created the Khmer Rouge and brought it to power. Kissinger then compounded his brutality by supporting the genocidal Khmer Rouge, telling the Thai foreign minister on November 26, 1975, quote, "You should also tell the Cambodians," meaning the Khmer Rouge government, "that we will be friends with them. They are murderous thugs, but we won't let them stand in the way. We are prepared to improve relations with them. Tell them the latter part, but don't tell them what I said before," unquote. Kissinger diverted billions of dollars in food for peace meant to feed the starving in those areas, and instead he gave it to the corrupt Lon Nol armies. He violated U.S. Constitution by secretly bombing Cambodia and Laos without congressional authorization, and his representatives regularly perjured themselves before Congress. Gee, what a surprise. Pathological liars, generals, everybody. You can lie all you want in this Congress. No one's going to hold you accountable. As when U.S. Ambassador to Laos testified to the Kennedy Subcommittee on Refugees on April 22, 1971, that the U.S. only bombed military targets in Laos. Lie upon lie. Inclusion, who lost Indochina? Was it Congress for not funding it, or was it Kissinger and his band of mad generals? Quote, "Had I thought it possible that Congress would, in effect, cut off aid to a beleaguered ally, I would not have pressed for an agreement as I did in the final negotiations in 1972. That's what Kissinger said in ending the Vietnam War. Quote, "The Defense Department said today that despite congressional reductions in military aid, South Vietnamese forces were not critically short of either ammunition or fuel." And who said that? That is, the arms situation in Vietnam is not critical. Read the New York Times, March 27, 1975. Henry Kissinger began to try to blame Congress for the fall of Saigon even before April 30, 1975. Sorley's book contends that the failure of the North Vietnamese Spring 1972 offensive in South Vietnam proves that the South Vietnamese forces could have prevailed in April of 1975. Newsweek, interviewing Sorley, reported, quote, "In 1974, breaking Nixon's promises of continued support to Saigon, the U.S. Congress cut off all aid to South Vietnam without logistical support or air cover. The South Vietnamese army collapsed in 1975 and the communists swept into South Vietnam," unquote. Former Defense Secretaries Melvin Laird and James Schlesinger, along with Henry Kissinger, have consistently maintained the North Vietnamese were receiving more aid from the South, from the Soviet Union and China, than were the South Vietnamese from the United States. Absolute lies. Total, complete, fabricated lies. Congress did not cut off all aid to South Vietnam, as Kissinger falsely claims. On the contrary, Congress in August 1974 only reduced military aid to Thu from $1.2 billion to $700 million. The $700 million in military aid voted by Congress, quote, "is apparently running at twice that of Chinese and Soviet military aid to North Vietnam, unquote. The CIA estimated that the U.S. military aid of $1.7 billion to the corrupt government of South Vietnam in 1974 was four times the $400 million given to the North Vietnamese by the Soviets and the Chinese. All told, official figures show that the U.S. spent $141 billion in Vietnam from 1961 to 75, compared to $7.5 billion from the Chinese and the Soviets combined. $141 billion from the U.S., $7 billion from them during the same period of time. That's according to the Congressional Record, May 14, 1975. Sorley's contention that the failure of the North Vietnamese 1972 offensive proved that the South Vietnamese Army could stand on its own is particularly absurd. Sorley himself quotes General Crichton Abrams, the head of U.S. forces in South Vietnam, as saying, quote, "On this question of the B-52s and the TAC Air, it's very clear to me that this," meaning the South Vietnamese government, "would now have fallen, and this would now be gone, and we wouldn't be meeting here today if it hadn't been for the U.S. B-52s and attack air. There's absolutely no question about it," unquote. In conclusion, during the 1972 offensive, the Times reported on May 3, 1972, that, quote, "The growing consensus among Americans here is that the South Vietnamese forces have proven unequal to the task of defending it. And despite 4 years of Vietnamization, and American and South Vietnam military commanders here have relied less and less on the government ground troops to stem the current North Vietnamese offensive than on instrument of massive bombing that only the Americans had, the B-52s. Neil Sheehan reported in his biography of U.S. Advisor John Paul Van, who directed U.S. and Vietnamese military forces in Region 3 in the spring of 1972, quote, "Van did not see the fallacy in his victory. He did not see that in having to assume total control at the moment of crisis, he had proved that Saigon regime had no will of its own to survive." We all have a natural tendency to want to forget an unpleasant past. Even many of us whose lives are deeply affected by the Indochina War often prefer to put those years of anguish, divisiveness, and anger behind us. Unfortunately, it is not that simple. Those who cannot remember the past are indeed condemned to repeat it. Future historians will marvel at how U.S. leaders so thoroughly failed to learn from their horrific mistakes and crimes in Indochina, and have instead repeated many of them today in Iraq, Afghanistan, and Pakistan. It is clear to all but the most blind or brainwashed that the basic lesson of Indochina is that the United States cannot create democratic and stable governments out of corrupt, brutal, autocratic, and unpopular warlords who can neither direct nor motivate their own people. Secretary Clinton is not only insulting history and betraying her own past by giving a platform to Henry Kissinger to continue distorting history, she is betraying America today, foolishly perpetrating policies toward the Muslim world that can only end in even greater losses to U.S. I'm Gary Nall, and that's a commentary. And just as two asides, I was told by one of my listeners, I did not hear it, that in one of his rants about why we have to fear the most loathsome of people today, the progressives, and, oh, you mean people who care about everyone, including the poor? Yeah. Well, he was talking about how we have to go back to the values of our founders. Okay, little lesson in history. The founders, you mean Benjamin Franklin and Thomas Jefferson, George Washington, Alexander Hamilton, James Madison, John Quincy Adams, who are you referring to? Those people came much later. Why don't we go back more than 100 years to the real founders? The real founders of the United States, even before the Plymouth sailing on the Mayflower arrived in 1620 with 102 passengers from Plymouth, England, and they landed in Massachusetts just near the tip of Cape Cod, half of them were Puritan passengers, half were not. There had been a previous expedition. England's first colony in America was born Jamestown. Jamestown, Virginia. And what was interesting is who brought them over here and what was their motives? Well, the fact is, historical fact, is that they believed that they had to follow the example of Spain. And Spain at that time, we're talking about in the early 1600s, was the most powerful nation as far as its foreign colonies and the gold it was extracting from those colonies and silver. And so it was the search for gold and believing that the bigger deposits of gold will be found in the northern hemisphere rather than the southern hemisphere, and already the southern hemisphere was controlled by Spain. So one individual took it upon himself to put a group of people together. His name was Bartholomew Gosnold, and he founded a company, and that company was an investment group. It was called the Virginia Corporation. It was a private corporation. And he got together a crew of craftsmen, people who could build things, and a crew of business people. Now, this is December 1606. Three ships set sail. Well, it was a bad journey. The journey normally took 3 months. This time it took 4 months. There were 108 men. We hear about John Smith, and that everything was Captain John Smith. Well, Captain John Smith was a second. The first was Captain Bartholomew, but he died early on. And they were concerned about failed missions. Now, what did they face when they came to America? Just in this one area, there was a native tribe, and it was about 13,000 Native Americans living under Powhatan, its chief, and Pocahontas, his daughter. And what you've read in the history books is really myth. She was only about 10 to 12 years of age, but she saved them. Without Pocahontas' intervention on her father's behalf, they would not have received the corn that kept them alive when they were starving to death. And so what happened was that 70% of the people died, and they died because they were looking for gold from the first day they arrived. They were out there with all their gold sifting in a bay. Now, mind you, it wasn't a bay. It was like a tributary. It was called a river, but it really wasn't a river as such because it didn't have a northern point of water flowing south into the Atlantic. Instead, it was like a tributary where brackish water backed up, salt water backed up and went up into this tributary, and that's where they landed. Well, it didn't take them long to realize that they hadn't found gold, but they had found dysentery and typhoid and starvation. And anyone who loses 50 men in 3 months, in their first 3 months, 50 men died. And why did they die? Well, first, because half of the crew, one half, were business people who refused to work. They considered themselves the aristocracy. They wouldn't do anything for themselves. And the 50% of the crew, half the crew who could work, were skilled at what they did, but none of them thought about bringing seed to grow. And they weren't there. They didn't think they were going to have to be planting crops and so they only had what they had stored. And generally when you traveled, you had dried, salted, or pig grease, preserved meat or fish. And generally everything else was rotten before you got there. Well, that's what happened. So now when people get sick and they're drinking water, they're drinking salt water. It also happened that one of the worst droughts that the natives had ever remembered in their lifetime was occurring then, which meant that the water was more concentrated in salt, and it was dirty. So every day, all the water that they would drink was salt water. Now, when you drink salt water, it dries out your system. It dehydrates your organs. It creates massive biochemical imbalances. And people were just dying like flies. And then they ran out of food. They had no food to eat. And they were afraid to go out of the fort because of the Indians. And finally, it was and the original founder of the whole company, Bartholomew, died, and he was buried outside the fort. And so it was this one man who took a gamble, John Smith, and who went to the chief with some trinkets. The chief took the trinkets. Pocahontas liked the trinkets, and they got corn. That's how they survived. That's accurate. And then they called this the starving time. So John Smith then returned to England and came back, and more people came back, and they had a terrible time in 1610. They ate crops, then they ran out of crops, and then the natives attacked, and a lot of people were killed. But then there were men and women, there were about 215. About 70% died, frequently the plague, because when they came back, rats came back, and the lice on the rats were infected. And there were only 60 survivors, and they were so, mind you, they were so starved that they ate everything they could, and finally they went out and dug up the corpses of those who had died and ate them. So the people that founded America had to eat corpses in order to survive. Not a good idea. So that's just one of the... So America was founded based upon the idea of let's go over there and get the gold, and we can deal with the natives as the Spanish had done. Now, another thing I'm concerned about is how we have completely denied that there's any real responsibility for all the civilians killed in Iraq and Afghanistan or Pakistan. You're looking at displaced, made homeless, and killed men, women, and children, 1.5 million dead, high figure, 1 million low figure, another 3 million made homeless. Not a single inquiry, not a single commission. Just as one quick memory, think of May Lai, M-Y-L-A-I, May Lai, summer of 1968. 567 innocent civilians were murdered in just one morning. Charlie Company. And it started at started in the morning, Captain Medino, and they were looking for the 48th Vietnam Battalion. They were told that it was around May Lai. They were wrong. It was 150 miles away. And so on March 16th, 1968, they invaded. And there was one really conscientious person. He was a pilot. His name was Hugh Thompson. And he's watching people, old people and women, just being shot. And he's in a helicopter. And finally, he just sets down his helicopter. And he tries to get to the people to save them. And he was able to save some. But there was also a man named Callie who was responsible for killing all of these people. So anyhow, when all this was said and done, they tried to cover it up. Clear up the command. Everybody covered it up. Not a word about this massacre anywhere. And then there was Thompson who reported, told a Colonel Henderson, and what happened, and it took about 2 months to hide this one group. They actually sent Charlie Company into a very, very dangerous area for 2 months to hide them so that nobody could interview them, so they could keep it covered up. But there was a person who took photographs. And the photographs were finally given by an Army combat photographer 1 year after the slaughter to the Cleveland Plains dealer. They published it, then Life magazine published it, and then they were forced to do an inquiry. And Secretary of the Army, Stanley Reeser, denied that there was a problem. Everybody denied it. And then there was a commission formed called the PEERS, P-E-E-R-S Commission, held hearings. And on March 17, 1970, 2 years after this, they came out with 30 persons were found guilty of covering it up, including a two-star general. And Lieutenant Callie was found to have killed the most people personally, women and children. And he was given 4 counts of guilty. He spent a grand total, I think, of 4 months. That's it. Then there was a massive Free Kelly movement around the United States. And President Nixon released Kelly. And Nixon was getting 25,000 letters a day. So here was Kelly serving 4 months in Fort Leavenworth, and the American people, a lot of them, didn't believe he should be held personally responsible. People believe that in war, things happen, and you have to accept that. And so no one was held accountable. No one had any problems. 567 innocent people killed in one morning, and we washed it. Today, 1.5 million dead people, and we wash it. And yet we will hear people, the neocons and the hard right, saying, and even the blue dog Democrats, oh, you know, let's put all that behind us. Easy for you to say when you're not the one on the receiving end. That's why I'm so opposed to war and the permanent war machine that exists in our country. I'm Gary Knoll. Those are my thoughts. Time for you to give your thoughts. Here's our number to call in now. Give us a call. I'd like to hear what you have to say. 888-874-4888. 888-874-4888. Because we do deal with social issues. We do deal with them in ways that bring attention to them from different points of view. I'd like to hear your thoughts. While you're thinking about that, I will give you the latest on health and nutrition update back in a moment. Please stay with us. This is the home for independent and progressive-minded individuals looking at issues from a different perspective. I've just given you the truth about why we lost Vietnam, because it was a corrupt war with a corrupt regime and an army that would not fight for itself. It had nothing to do with the lack of our support financially, with troops and American lives. They're doing the same thing today. Oh, we have to give them more troops. Oh, we have to give them more money. No, every nickel and every drop of blood now in Iraq and Afghanistan is with no benefit and no honor. Now we'll wait for your calls. The lines are open. Give us a call. Share your thoughts. 888-874-4888. Wouldn't it be nice if every member of Congress, all members of the Supreme Court, including the women, all members of every agency in Washington were the only ones that were allowed to fight in wars? Might have a different perspective on wars then. Or all of the children and wives of Wall Street bankers and CEOs of Fortune 500 companies, they're the ones who have to be in the front lines. So if someone's going to step on a mine and get blown to hell, let it be someone from Goldman Sachs. Ah, boy. Would that give them a different perspective on profiteering from the war? Anyhow, breastfeeding. That prevents babies' infections. Now, think of all the children that end up with ear infections and get all these antibiotics that only hurt them. A BBC report says exclusive breastfeeding for 6 months wards off baby infections. And that's good news. So that's in the Archives of Diseases in Childhood. Let's get our children to be healthy by breastfeeding. And one other one before I go to your calls. Are genetically engineered foods, including salmon, more allergenic? Well, we've been told by the FDA not to worry. And we've been told by the Aqua Bounty Technologies that's making these frankenfish not to worry. Worry. Because, quote, the safety, according to Consumers Union senior scientist Michael Hansen, is woefully incomplete. And the group pointed out that the FDA approval panel is mostly comprised of, gee whiz, genetically engineered pro-scientists. Why are we surprised? So don't eat the genetically engineered fish. Boycott it. And finally, Obama's health care reform imposes a 3.8% tax on all income from home sales and home rental income. We weren't told about this. No, but it just keeps getting worse. Every time you turn around, another revelation pops up from that fetid, despicable piece of legislation that should be trashed and thrown out in a garbage, but it's too toxic for normal garbage sites. It should go into one of those incompatible with life sites. The newest revelations concern 3.8% tax on income from home sales and home rentals. This is going to go into effect in another couple years. And why weren't we told about it? Well, they hid it from us. Let's say hello to Terry in Washington, D.C. Hi, Terry. You're on the air.
A question, and it's regarding this idea of this will to kill. And I think that we need to stop calling everything a war and just call it exterminate, because then it will make it clear in the minds of people exactly what that's all about.
If we did that, we would be allowing people to focus upon the actual consequence. Did you ever see the movie Apocalypse Now?
No.
Okay, there's a scene in there where they want to kill a general who's gone rogue on him. So the CIA and the military send in Charlie Sheen's character to do the assassination. But they don't say, go and blow the guy's head off, take a knife, stick it in his brain, shoot him in the face. Instead, they say, exterminate with extreme prejudice. When you say someone is a casualty of friendly fire, it's kind of Shirley Temple-ish. It doesn't sound that bad. Then show a baby with napalm. Show a baby with white phosphorus. Show a baby or child with their head blown off.
Uh-huh.
Then you see what it is. I believe.
But I'm saying, I think that those of us on the progressive side, not necessarily, we know that this industrial complex is not going to call it that, but I think that we owe it to ourselves to call it that, because to me, all I'm seeing is just people of color around the world with these heavy, I know things happened in World War I and World War II, but it just seems to me that I'm just seeing so many different groups of people of color, and I'm seeing it as white supremacy, and I see white supremacy as racism, and racism is white supremacy, and it's as if there's this will to kill and exterminate. And nobody can say, a million people over there, imagine the grieving and the pain and the misery of missing a loved one. I mean, just one family, and then you multiply that by a million. I mean, it is just absolutely a deplorable thing.
But remember, it is an uncivilized world. It is Secretary Hillary Clinton, whose husband and she, as co-president, decided that their Secretary of State, Madeleine Albright, would continue the sanctions, which they knew in advance would only affect children, and 500,000, a half million dead children. That's genocide by any measure. And on Leslie Stahl's interview on 60 Minutes, when asked, is the death of a half million children justifiable? She says, yes. And I just about dropped off the chair when I saw that. So keep in mind, it's not about white. That's where I would stop and say, pull back. It's about green. We only have war because of the color green.
But the whites have the green. The majority of the whites have the green.
Well, first of all, the majority of the whites don't have green, but the minority of the whites who have the green have the power. It is the empowerment of the rich and elite. And once I don't care if you're a Latino or black, just like Colin Powell, he's the one who sat in the UN and told us absolutely positively had all the evidence. Condoleezza Rice, you become white, and then whites become green, and you morph into this color of power. It is not about one group. It is about the nature of greed and the nature of hubris and the loss of spiritual values. I thank you very much for your thoughts. Marie from Baltimore. Hi, Marie.
I hope I'm not repeating with the last person, but a little bit I am. In a sense, it seemed like some... Can you hear me?
Yes, go
okay.
ahead.
Okay, some people here that you hear on the radios here, they want to whip up some war against the Muslims. And people don't know or remember that a lot of the slaves from Africa who came over to this country, didn't come over, I mean, they were brought over, were Muslims. They don't know that. So did those Muslims, slaves that were brought over here, take over the plantations? Of course not. But the talk that I'm hearing on the radio, they feel the Muslims are a great threat to this country. And I can't get the mindset of these people. Don't they know of the situation down there in New Orleans and...
They don't care about that.
And what's that other catastrophe, that company, BP, yeah. British Petroleum?
I'll do a commentary on the history of BP. I don't have time today. We're out of time.
Mm-hmm.
Showing you that it was an imperial design of the same people, Cecil Rhodes and Winston Churchill, who allowed, actually motivated British Petroleum to take over Iraq. And its oil supplies, or Iranian oil supplies, and I'll go into that on another time. But there is almost a codification and institutionalization of racism based upon elitism. It can come from any group. And to fear Muslims today, well, then what you're doing is you're looking into your own soul, and what you fear most about yourself, you're projecting upon another person or another race or another group. It is unfortunate. But these blathers of the airwave, these people have as much credibility as what goes down with some severe diarrhea in a toilet in the morning. Thank you.
Thank you.
We're out of time. I'm sorry I couldn't get any more calls up. I look forward to sharing more with you tonight. If you're on the East Coast, get up at 3 or 4 or 5 and turn on Progressive Radio Network. You'll have a link to KPFK, and I'll be talking for 6 hours. And tomorrow at noon on Progressive Radio Network. Have a nice day, everyone.
The Gary Knoll Show is produced in our New York City studios. The producer is Richard Gale. The engineer is Matt Bogart. All shows are archived by Joe Kemp. Our chief archivist is Sharon Pride, and the program director is Carol Lee.